Welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. I'm Lav Harkov, senior contributing editor and diplomatic correspondent. And we have, returning from 3 weeks off, editor-in-chief of the Jerusalem Post, Yaakov Katz. Welcome back.
Great to be back, Lav. Missed the podcast, missed Israel, missed the paper, was out west in the U.S. seeing amazing sights in national parks. But as beautiful as all that is, and it is beautiful, there's nothing like being home. So great to be here. And we have the Olympics. So exciting. So far, one, as we're recording this, so far one medal for Israel, right? I love the Olympics. Like as I sit in my office here in Jerusalem, there's a television across the room in the newsroom. I have it on the sports channel, watching all the different, obviously the Israeli athletes, but like all the crazy diving, swimming, gymnastics, yeah, you know, whatever it is. It's just great to watch. And so far, we have Avishag Semberg, a 19-year-old yes, winning in Taekwondo, which is something I didn't even know we had an athlete who was competing in Taekwondo. We're big judo people in Israel, right? Or windsurfing. Yeah,
but Israel's good at a lot of different martial arts. I mean, not I don't think this was the first time we medaled in Taekwondo, but definitely competing in all of that.
That's definitely exciting. And coming up this weekend are the big games for Team Israel in baseball. We have a conversation in the show with Ellie Wergelander, who is a longtime journalist here in Israel, worked for the Jerusalem Post for many years, has been covering Team Israel and writing about them, was just out at some exhibition games. Big baseball fan. I love baseball. I'm sure, you know, you grew up in New York. Come on, you must have loved some baseball also, no?
Oh, yes. We went to a lot of Mets games.
Yeah, Mets. You see, now that's a problem. I think Ellie's a Yankees fan. I don't know. We'll see where our listeners come from. And you know, back when I grew up in Chicago, it was always, are you a Cubs fan? Are you a White Sox fan? I'm a Cubs fan, to all those who might be concerned. But it's a big, and I think for Israel, Lahav, correct me if I'm wrong, right, you know, Israelis don't play baseball. It's not a big game here. I think probably the vast majority of Israelis don't know the difference between a ball, a strike, a hit, a home run, a double, a triple, whatever all that might be. But it'd be interesting.
You're saying they don't know
how
the difference. They don't know what any of those things are. But there's a tiny softball league in Israel.
Yeah, but I mean, I think it'll be interesting to see what happens if we get a medal out of this. And will that do anything to baseball? Will Israeli kids suddenly want to play baseball? And will Israelis get excited just beyond the fact that some Israeli team got a medal, but the fact that, you know, we broke through into this new sport to an extent in the Olympics. So that'll definitely be interesting.
I will say, like, from what I've heard of it, I mean, I don't really listen to a lot of, like, sports media or things like that. I have watched a few Olympic things because I also enjoy it. But from what I've heard on sort of the general news programs is that, like, people just are making a little bit of a joke of it. Like, they're like, oh, it's actually just a bunch of Americans wearing a costume, you know, wearing uniforms with the Israeli flag on it. But I think that if we medal, it seems like it's a long shot, but if Israel wins the medal, then that could change.
Yeah, of course. If they get the medal, they'll be happy. Well, with that happening, if we turn maybe to the more serious news, although this is pretty serious stuff, the Olympics, so I wouldn't necessarily say it's not serious, but in the more serious news, lot moving, Lahav, on your beat on the U.S.-Israel front, right? You had a story the other day about the Naftali Bennett government saying that if they get a court decision that they're allowed to evict those Arab homes in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of East Jerusalem, he's not going to be acting on it, which is interesting and kind of maybe eyeing Washington, where he's sending off some of his top aides this coming week to start to prepare for his trip, which is expected there maybe at the end of August. And there's a lot to talk about between him and Biden on Iran, the Palestinians. I don't know what's going on in Syria. Maybe just give us some insight, kind of what's happening on that front.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned the Sheikh Jarrah thing. This is a long-standing property dispute, basically between Jews who owned the property before 1948, and then they sold it to an organization that's currently fighting for it, and Arab families that have been living there since 1948. For the Bennett government, it's almost just like a win-win to not actually evict anyone if the verdict allows for an eviction, which chances are it will. And certainly when it comes to international pressure, including the Americans, you know, people are opposing it and putting pressure on Israel not to evict. And also politically, you know, this government is half right, half left, and it's just one more dispute between the two sides that Bennett can avoid. Of course, it'll be difficult for him on his, in his base, in his right-wing base of voters. But, you know, sort of politically and diplomatically in other ways, I think it benefits him. But going back to the U.S., so next week, two of Bennett's top advisors, Shimrit Meir is diplomatic advisor and Eyal Hulata is new national security advisor, who also is an interesting person. They are going to be heading to the U.S. to prepare for Bennett's trip, which is expected to be sometime in August. The exact date has not been publicized yet. And Iran is definitely at the top of the agenda. Right now, the government of Israel is extremely concerned about this lull in the talks or the indirect talks between the U.S. and Israel to rejoin the Iran deal. On the one hand, the Israeli government opposes the Iran deal. On the other hand, there's this sort of state of limbo, and people keep using, everyone I'm talking to keeps using the word limbo, so I'm guessing that that's the word they're using in cabinet meetings as well. That this state of limbo where there's no negotiations going on and it's unclear what the International Atomic Energy Agency inspections regime is going to be, Israel's worried that Iran's taking advantage of it to sort of run to the bomb so that they, when they come back to talks, which the earliest date would be next week because Iran said they won't do it until their new president is installed. So when they return to the talks, they'll suddenly be at a far more advanced point and be able to make greater demands. So I think that not only will they be preparing for a trip that's, you know, in a few weeks, that Bennett's top advisors are going to be sort of driving this point home. Iran is definitely the top of the agenda.
And your feeling is that can Israel really influence the deal? Or, I mean, there was that interview that Rob Malley, who's like the special envoy from the administration to the Iran talks, gave to MSNBC earlier this week. And basically he talked about offers that have been made to the Iranians to lift all the sanctions. And the Iranians keep on rejecting those offers and multiple offers that had been made by the U.S. The question kind of is, if the U.S. is willing to do all that and to really give the Iranians such economic relief by lifting so many sanctions, if not all, what can Israel really hope to get out of the talks? Is it can they influence the deal, or is it just to talk about compensation from a return to the deal?
So, first of all, Iran, I think, is taking full advantage of how much the U.S. wants to return to the deal. And so they're demanding not only a lifting of all the sanctions, but their latest demand, which is reported in the Wall Street Journal, is that they want there to be like an article in the deal that would require the U.S. to get permission from the United Nations in order to withdraw from the deal. Now, the U.S., it's unconstitutional. Like, they can't do that. But it just shows where their mindset is, you know, the Iranians, where the U.S. wants to just go back to the 2015 Iran deal and then after that see where they could move forward. And for Iran, they want their own version of a longer and stronger deal, which is not the version that the U.S. and certainly not Israel would like to see. As far as what Israel can influence, I think the message that Israel is sending to the U.S. and also to France, UK, and Germany, which are the European parties to the deal, is that, you know, if Iran is closer than is acceptable to a nuclear weapon, and that these countries have to show that they'd be willing to do something. If they don't want Israel to do something, then they have to do something to make Israel safe. And as far as I can tell, that's the message at this point. Even though let's put it this way, I haven't been able to get any confirmation, but I would not be surprised if Israel will try to get some sort of extra aid package to deal with the Iranian threat.
I think that's the most it can ask for at this stage. And, you know, I know we've reported in the past about how Israel wants to begin talks with the U.S. about a new military aid package for when the current one expires in a few years. I guess if it's not a case of if you can't beat him, join him, because Israel's never going to join this deal or endorse it. And I think we will hear Prime Minister Bennett pay lip service to, you know, Israel having its independence and be able to do whatever it wants and not being bound by such a deal. But ultimately, I think Israel's hands will be tied. And I think, they will have to try to do their best to maneuver, at least to try to get something out of it in terms of maybe compensation of new military hardware, equipment upgrade, and intelligence sharing, as intimate as it already is. But it's going to be a tough one. It's going to be a tough lift. And it's going to be it'll be an interesting meeting when it happens. And we'll obviously, cover that very closely for when that trip comes up. But we also spoke this week with a former Knesset member, Xenia Svetlova, who is a real Middle East expert, is now a fellow at the multidisciplinary or interdisciplinary center, IDC in Herzliya, as well as at Mitmim, which is another research think tank here in Israel. And we spoke to her about the Syria situation. Right, Lahav, what's the latest on that? There was a really controversial report that came out about Israel, Syria, and Russia.
So there's a report in Asharq al-Awsat, which is an Arabic language newspaper based in London, and a pretty serious news outlet, that basically said that Russia is sick of Israeli strikes on Iranian targets in Syria, and that Russia is going to sort of do more to stop it. That they don't think that Israel is really keeping to its side of the deconfliction agreement between Israel and Russia. Now, there have been some anonymous denials in Israel, but a lot of analysts take it seriously. I think it's interesting because I feel like in a lot of areas of international relations, not everywhere, but in many, it's not necessarily, Netanyahu likes to say that his personal relationships with leaders were like the big thing that helped improve Israel's international standing in the past decade. But I think that that's proven to be, if not totally wrong, then exaggerated in many cases in the past 6 weeks since Bennett came into office. But this did make me wonder if it is true about Russian President Vladimir Putin, with whom Netanyahu had a very strong relationship.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. So we'll hear from, we're going to hear from Ellie Wergelander about the Olympics, Xenia Svetlova about Syria, two different sides of the same coin of Israel. One hopes for Olympics, an Olympic medal, and the other hope for regional stability. So it all comes together here in Israel, and here we go. It's great to have on the show Ellie Wergelander. He's a longtime veteran journalist here in Israel, worked for many years at the Jerusalem Post. And Ellie, you have been covering intensely, I might say, Team Israel, the baseball team that has that is playing on behalf of Israel in the Summer Olympics in Tokyo.
Yes.
Miraculously. Yes. It's almost like a Hollywood film that we have these Jews who are playing baseball in the Olympics on behalf of the state of Israel, where baseball is barely a game. So why don't you tell us, and you were just at some exhibition games that they had in upstate New York and Pennsylvania, probably some other places. What's the schedule? When are they playing? What are they playing? How did they get to be where they are? And should we expect anything miraculous to happen?
The last question, of course, is what everybody is asking. Can Israel win a medal? And it's baseball. And in baseball, anything can happen. Everyone knows this because that's the very nature of the sport. Anything can happen. And that's true in every sport. The old football maxim, on any given Sunday, any team can beat any team. Any team can any sport, of course. The odds are against it that Israel is going to win a medal by far. The odds listed in multiple websites and online betting places, they've all said that one of them didn't even have Israel in their first lineup of probability. Israel was not listed. In any case, the games are starting, the baseball tournament in the Olympics is starting tomorrow, Wednesday. Israel will play its first game at 1 o'clock on Thursday against Korea. They'll play its second game at 1 o'clock on Friday against the United States. This is Israel time. And then there's a third game over the weekend. If they lose those first three games, then they're out. So they need to win one of the first three to move on. And then the moving on is a whole other stage next week, a little complicated in how it works, but let's get there first and then we can talk about that.
So could you tell us the story of how Israel, a country where baseball is almost non-existent, it managed to qualify for the Olympics in baseball?
It's by the grace of gods, the baseball gods, as they're known, that Israel is in fact in playing in the Olympics. It was
Who are the baseball gods? Do they have names?
They're the Babe Ruth would be a baseball god, but we're talking about the in the firmament above. There's all kinds of blessings to be said for the miraculous occurrence of Israel playing in the Olympics. It began in the summer of 2019. It actually began, the history of this team began in 2012 when Israel first started to play in a high-level international tournament known as the World Baseball Classic. And they played in 2012 and they lost in 2016 in qualifier and they won. In 2017, they came in last of the 16 teams that were playing in the World Baseball Classic in the spring of 2017. And they finished sixth. Just extraordinary. Just an extraordinary run. And then in the summer of 2019, they had to play four tournaments in four countries, two in July and two in September. And at the end, they had won 17 out of 21 games during those two summer months. And they qualified for the Olympics in the European African division of world baseball.
Who's there? Israelis don't play baseball. Like who are the players? Who's the pitcher? Who's shortstop? It's not it's not Shmulik, you know, Levy from you know Jerusalem or Ashkelon. Who are these people?
No offense
to Shmulik.
Actually, four of the people on the team actually are Shmulik. There are four Shmuliks on this team. Asaf Lowengart, Alon Leishman, Tal Errol, and the legend of Israel baseball, Shlomo Lipitz. Those four are Israeli born and raised who grew up playing baseball in the baseball of the country of Israel, which, granted, was and still is very small, maybe 1,000 kids and adults, teenagers and adults play baseball in Israel, maybe 1,000. But these four are the best of those. The rest of the team consists of 24 total, four Israelis and 20 American-born Israelis. These American-born Israelis are Jews who have played college baseball, professional baseball, major leagues, minor leagues, summer leagues. These are experienced players all, every single one of them. And some of them have made it to the major leagues. Eight of the players, in fact, have made it to the major leagues. So this is not a shoddy team. And they all have a chip on their shoulder for one reason or another. And the reason why these American Jews can play is because, in fact, they are also Israelis. They all came here, registered with Misrata Panim, with the Interior Ministry, and received a passport and 2 Datsahut. And these are card-carrying Israelis. So therefore, they get to play for Israel. Why? Because they're Jewish and therefore are eligible for citizenship in countries, any country, and get citizenship, and then play for that country. That's true for all countries in the world.
Can I ask you a serious question though for one moment? A really serious question. So I moved to Israel in 1993, and I think that around that time, you and I played in a softball league, together.
Different.
But when you saw me play then, do you think that I was good enough to be in the Olympics or prime?
No. Thank you for asking. No, absolutely not. Close.
I wanted to clear that because I don't, you know, I'm Lahav. I'm not sure knew about that. And, you know, I just wanted to be sure that we got that out of the way. You know? Exactly.
Very important ethical behavior.
So listen, in the baseball world, this is about as exciting as it gets outside of the World Series. High-level baseball in the Olympics, and baseball fans everywhere are extremely excited about this. And you can read all about it this Friday in the Jerusalem Post.
Yes, so this is the place to say that we have a big article, sorry, Lahav, by you about the Olympics and about the team, with interviews, really in-depth interviews about the players and their Jewish identity. Will be online, available for everyone to read, of course, is online and in print. Lahav, you go ahead.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you what it was like going to those exhibition games. I have a few friends in the U.S. in different communities who went out, so one in New Jersey, one in somewhere in Maryland. I don't know if it was Baltimore, Silver Spring or what. And they all said they had a great time. So I just want to know sort of what was the atmosphere like at those games?
Everybody who came to those games had a good time. It was a wonderful atmosphere, a warm, embracing, loving atmosphere, cheering on the team. Go Israel, go to the Olympics, come back with a medal. It was exhilarating. The games themselves were just exhibition games. And when I say exhibition games, there was no keeping score, although two of us did. Because there was no need to. I mean, batters were batting out of turn. There were 10-man lineups. There was free substitution. There was an inning called after two outs because it was late and they wanted to get the game over with. I'd never seen that. Anyway, but it was fun. It was fun for everybody. It was fun for the players. You know, they have to re-coordinate how they do a double play, 6-4-3. Yes, they've done it a million times, but everybody has their own rhythm, how fast you move, how you move over the base, how you cover the base, how you grab the ball, how you throw the ball. So they have to work that out. Reacquainting themselves with the interconnectedness of their play. And they did that, and that was fun. And the pitchers got a lot of work, and everybody got work. Everybody was in shape. And here we are after 22 months, after missing an entire year added to their schedule of preparing for the Olympics. They finally made it.
Ellie, a couple of questions, if I may. Number one is, you know, I don't know if everyone knows you who's listening, but you're a young man and you've been following baseball for a long time. Like you've seen, I think you told me once you saw Mickey Mantle play in Yankee Stadium.
I saw Mickey Mantle hit his 500th home run.
Wow. Okay.
And you are a diehard baseball fan. You watch the games live from Israel, which means you're not sleeping much in the middle of the night, right?
Often is the case. I plead guilty. Go ahead.
Are these guys good? Are they good? Like you know baseball. You watch them. Are they a good team?
That's a good question. Individually, some of these guys are outstanding. Okay, you have big names. Two specifically, you have Ian Kinsler. He was a guy who played in the major leagues for 14 years. He got 1,999 hits. Only about 350 people have 2,000 hits. And he only retired a year ago. So he's still in shape. And in fact, he hit a couple of home runs, during the exhibitions. The other one is Danny Valencia. Valencia played about 9 years, I think, in the major leagues. He also, only stopped playing, a year ago or so. I think Kinsler's 39, Valencia's 36. And so these guys are top level play. Six others made it to the major leagues. To make it to the major leagues, whatever happens after that, to make it to the major leagues, you are a very, very, very talented player. There was one guy on the team who only came in for an inning, and that's it. That's the only appearance in the major leagues. No difference. A person who has made it to the major leagues, they are very, very good. And so you have guys, so you have eight guys in this team. The other guys, one guy played in the minor leagues for 9 years. He was about to retire. He said, no, okay, I'll keep playing. For Israel. He's been playing with Israel since the beginning, since 2012. There are four guys on this team who have played with the team since the beginning. They played with them in 2012, 16, 17, and 19, and now the Olympics. In any case, so they are good. The answer is they are good. Are they great? Are they superior? They have the chance to be because they're very, very, very good. They're very, very good. And if on a given day in baseball, your offense is hitting and your pitchers are pitching, yes, you can easily steal away a game or two, easily.
Who is on the American team? Like, are they like Major League Baseball stars on the American team?
Excellent question. The major leagues and the Olympics are not mutually friendly and helpful to each other. So when the Olympics takes place every four summers, Major League Baseball does not interrupt the Major League season to allow the players on the team, the immediate 25, plus the additional 14, it's called the 40-man roster. And none of the people on the 40-man roster are allowed to play in the Olympics. The people in the for the major league teams in the minor leagues, players in single A, double A, triple A, they are allowed to go play in the Olympics. And many of them will be there. That will be the majority of the American team. There will be a couple of guys who, like Ian Kinsler and Danny Valencia on the Israeli team, are a couple of guys who just retired in the major leagues. And so they purposely left when they were cut or moved to that they'll be allowed to be able to play in the Olympics and did make the team. So it's a similar situation. So in that sense, it's not like they were Israel is up against major league power. They're not. There are a couple of guys on every team and all the countries who played in the major league. I believe Korea does not have any major leaguers on its roster, but every other country has 1, 2, 3, 4 guys. But our guys are good. There's another guy, Ryan LaVarnway. He's been playing on and off in the major leagues for 9 years, and he's still playing. But he was in the majors this summer for like 3 games, 4 games. Then went back down to the minors. Anyway, baseball is a crazy world.
Just to wrap us up. I got two questions. One is, give us your prediction. What happens? Does Israel advance? Does Israel get a medal?
I'm so afraid you're going to ask me that question. Go ahead. And your second question.
Okay. The second question is, remember that movie Cool Runnings about the Jamaican bobsledding team, right?
Yes.
Great movie.
Great movie. And no one thought that they could even make it. No one thought they could be in the Winter Olympics, and they did. Is this what we're seeing now? Is this like just, you know, are Israelis going to feel national pride about what the Israeli baseball team is doing?
That's a whole nother question. That involves the cultural level of Israeli involvement in the sport. At the moment, it's next to nothing. Will it get a big boost being in the Olympics? Of course. Will Israelis root for the team? Yes, of course. Will they know a ball from a strike? Probably not. But it'll start to grow. Certainly, if they win a medal, Israelis will jump up and down for joy because Israel doesn't win that many medals. So any medal is a good medal. The prediction, I will say, full disclosure, I did put down $35 on Team Israel to win the gold medal.
And don't overdo it there with that bet. That's high stakes, Ellie. You sure?
$35. I mean, for $35, if they win the gold medal, I'll win over $1,000.
Oh, so the odds are really bad.
The odds are real bad.
Well.
Put down your money. I'm telling you, put down your money.
I mean, this is
okay. We
got to
be careful because I don't want people
like
on this podcast
win, right?
To think we're soliciting gambling.
We're running a gambling joint out of the back cafe on MFM. Yes, that's where we are. Go ahead.
No, I was just saying this is probably one of these sports where like America just always wins.
No, you would think that.
No,
but the because
the Dominican,
the Japanese,
the Japanese in this right now in the world, Japan is ranked number one, and they're the home country, the home team. I mean, they have the stands. Of course, there are no fans, but they will
there's
have,
no one there.
Right, but they'll have the country rooting for them, and that's a big plus. And the United States, in fact, is ranked third in the world.
And is number
three,
two the Dominican Republic?
No, Dominican Republic is actually seventh, I believe. 1, 2, 1, 3, 4, 5. Yes, Dominican Republic is seventh. Korea is fourth, and Mexico is fifth, and Israel. The other five teams are ranked in the top seven, and Israel is 24th.
Ellie Wergelander, right. Who's been covering the Israel Team Israel in the Olympics baseball, big week this week, big week potentially next week. We might have a medal, might not. Big bet by Ellie for the gold. we wait with a lot of anticipation. Baseball is a fantastic game, and
it is.
And it'll be great to see what comes of Israel showing at these Olympics. Thanks for joining us.
You bet. Fun. Go Israel.
We're here with Ksenia Svetlova, a former Knesset member from the Zionist Union and an expert on Middle East affairs. Who's written for many publications, including the Jerusalem Report, and also does a lot of research on these issues. And our first question for you is about what is going on with Syria. Does Russia seem to be changing its policy towards Israeli strikes against Iranian targets in Syria?
Well, Lahav, first of all, thanks for inviting me. It's good to be here. Hi, Yaakov. I would like to say that I do not see a significant change of heart until now, despite the article that was published in Sharq al-Awsat that was relying on an anonymous source, and we still do not know who this source is. I was assured by some of the Russian sources that I'm in touch with that the report of the Sharq al-Awsat doesn't really have access to classified information, neither from the Minister of Defense, not from the Minister of Foreign Affairs. So this is first. We don't know who is the source of the information. Second of all, Russia never was particularly happy with the notion that Israel is doing in Syria whatever it likes. It notifies Russia according to the confliction agreements that both parties have. But basically, it's, pounding Iranian objects, Hezbollah, and others in the close proximity sometimes to Russian bases. And I remember at least a few very harsh statements that were made by Russian officials and Russian military, Russian defense officers that were saying that we are not satisfied, we will never tolerate it. And we see in this activity source of destabilization in Syria and in the region. So you do not have a specific change from this departure from this position. The question is, what will happen the next time there will be some air activity of IDF in Syria skies? I think this will be the test for the real intentions of Kremlin.
Do you think, though, that Russia would potentially take action to stop Israel beyond? Like, we know that the Russians helped the Syrians operate some of the air defense systems, right? It's important to keep in mind that all of the air defense systems that Syria has in its territory are Russian made. All the different kind of SA and different types of whatever number comes next, SA-200 or whatever it might be. But they sometimes operate them for the Syrians. But do you think that the Russians would actively try to take down an Israeli fighter jet or an Israeli drone if that's what's being flown into Syria? Will that day potentially come?
Well, of course, it's very difficult to predict, especially to predict the future, as they say. But what I can tell you is Russia is not interested in conflict with Israel. And it's not interested in creating a situation that it had before with Turkey and also in 2018 with Israel when the plane was downed, Russian plane was downed by Syrians, but they blame for it Israelis. I do not believe that for recreate some kind of a conflict here. However, for various reasons, it needs to show its allies in Syria, and this ally is Iran and Hezbollah. That it does not lean to the Israeli side. Russia is looking to play a big role here in the Middle East. The U.S. is leaving, or so it seems that it's leaving. Russia is taking more and more responsibility and more involved with regional affairs. It wants to show that all of the actors and all of the parties that take some part in the Syrian conflict in this way or another, they coordinate. And they consider Russia as a big power in their, in their minds and their considerations. So, whether it's related to the progress that the Americans are making in the negotiations with Iran, whether it's the big events that they were having in Damascus, just exactly on the day of the last attack, there was a big mission from Russia that came to Damascus. And they wanted basically to project that things are going normal right now. The war is over and the situation is under the control of the Russian forces. And the continuing Israeli activity, which is also very public, you know, it's not a secret anymore. It's not a, and nobody hides anymore as it used to be in the few years ago. It's actually, it's doesn't, you know, coincide with the Russian interest right now. So Russia is interested to continue and have good communication with all of the parties and possibly also to play these parties against each other, but to stay above them, to show them who is in charge here, who is in charge in Syria.
Oh, why do you say that Russia would want to play the parties against each other? Like what interest would Russia have in playing Israel against others in the region?
Well, only if it serves Russian interests, Lav. And we do not forget even for a second that despite the good activity and the stable connection that Israel and the Russian army have now around the Syrian situation in the deconfliction center, the strategic ally of Israel is the United States, period. With Russia, their relations are extremely important. However, they are tactical relations. And in Russia, in Syria, sorry, Russia relies on Iran. So I do not foresee a situation in which Russia will turn now against Iran. And I never thought that it's the case, that it will able to tell the Iranians, listen, you have to back off. You have to go back from the borders. You have to stop your activity because it irritates the Israelis. Just the opposite, you know. So I think that by having this tension there between Iran and Israel, Russia can act as a negotiator, perhaps, as a go-in between, as somebody who's responsible and who can calm the situation down, as they did actually already with Lebanon and with Hezbollah, if you remember, during the last hostility. The North.
What is Russia's ultimate objective here? Right, we know that they wanted to help save Bashar al-Assad. We know that they want to have regional influence in whether it's in Syria or in the Mediterranean. Now they have a naval base for the last few years near Tartus in Syria. But what's their ultimate, like, it's not, they're not trying to achieve Middle East peace, right? They're not trying to end the Iranian nuclear standoff. They're not trying to stabilize Iraq or Afghanistan. Like, what do they want really at the end of the day? Is it energy? Is it just dominant? What are they looking for?
Well, I think we have to look at the combination of interests. And of course, one of them is energy. And we see that Russia was able to secure a few very lucrative contracts to itself in Syria. And this is exactly what it's trying to do also in Lebanon. Russian Novatek actually has some shares in the exploration of the gas in the Mediterranean and the Lebanese part. But it's beyond that. It's not only the natural resources. Russia is very rich with national resources. It basically sees the Middle East as its background. As a region which is close to Russia in a geographical sense, the malign influence of Islam can also influence very badly the situation in the Muslim parts of Russia, in the Caucasus, in the Tatarstan, and in other places. It looks at, the exit to the warm waters, and it achieved the dream of Peter the First. You know, since that time, the dream is that old of having a base in the Mediterranean. And why is it important? Because Russia also looks itself as a vulnerable element that is threatened by NATO and by the West in general. So by securing some place for itself in the Mediterranean, which it never had before, Russia is basically saying, listen, I'm acting right now very close to your shores, to the shores of the EU. I'm here where all of the big players are. Nobody is surprised that the US has its contingent, in the Mediterranean. So we're also here. We are here because we know that NATO continues to expand. We see it as a threat. We always did. Putin never was oblivious about it. He always said that he looks in NATO, he sees a nemesis, he sees an enemy. And any move and any idea, and this is basically what is being discussed right now, in regards to possible entrance of Georgia or Ukraine joining the NATO. Okay, so Russia sees it as a direct threat. In this way, it looks to secure its own interests. First of all, its survival, its security, security of its regime. And on the way, yes, its weapon sales, its energy. And because of the growing sanctions pressure from the EU, from the US, the Middle East and Africa becomes more and more important. So is China, of course, yes, if we are talking economics. So these are basically the goals. And again, look at every place where Russia is operating. In Turkey, you have now, you know, this alliance between Russia and Turkey, but Russia also has good relations with the Kurds. It's friends with Israel, but also with Iranians and Hezbollah. It receives in Moscow delegations of Fatah, but also Hamas and the Islamic Jihad. It likes to play, you know, in the big game and to have all of the cards close to its chest and have the ability to make the right move when it sees that it serves its interests.
So you mentioned Lebanon, and I wanted to sort of move to that topic as well. You know, the Lebanon's the economy in collapse and its government just really not being able to control much anymore. And thing, the situation is just getting worse and worse there. And there's a lot of concern that, you know, that will somehow trickle down to Israel. Not that Israel will spin out of control, but that it will threaten Israel in some way. We already saw people trying to sneak into Israel over the northern border. And I guess I just want to hear your assessment of how this may or may not affect Israel.
Well, I believe that everything that happens in the vicinity of our borders, whether it's the instability in Lebanon, whether it's the dire economic crisis in Jordan or in Palestinian autonomy, will it's you know, eventually it will, of course, it will influence Israel. So the situation is Lebanon is being fragile for years. And I think since 2019, we can talk about Lebanon as of a failed state. What does it mean? That in this failed state, there is only one organization that is powerful enough to survive and also to secure its spheres of influence and dominance. And this is Hezbollah. And again, you know, we are not surprised as Israelis because we've been following the situation for years. I personally have been to Lebanon twice and I covered Lebanon for the Jerusalem Post at the time. And I can tell you that the Lebanese army was always weak, and we in Israel always was watching with a you know big amount of you know disbelief in the ability of the army to control southern Lebanon or other areas. And now we see you know that this the worst case scenario is happening. Lebanon will cease you know being one state; it will become a Hezbollahstan. In some part, it will be perhaps ruled by other militias, just like it was in the civil war at some point. But in southern Lebanon and Beirut, these are the areas that are important to Israel. Of course, all of this strip will be managed by Hezbollah. I do not think that Hezbollah right now, when the country is on the brink of collapse, is interested in armed conflict with Israel, despite the few shootings that were made during the last few weeks in our northern border. However, in the long term, I think that Hezbollah will be empowered by you know it's being basically the sole actor with all of the abilities and the finances and weapons in its hands. And I can tell you that the precision rocket project, it's right now, it currently, it's the largest danger on our national security, more than Gaza, possibly also more than you know the nuclear file of Iran because this is more immediately. So you know the some kind of confrontation with Hezbollah will probably occur in the next few years. I think in the short term Hezbollah will be actually discouraged from starting another regional war in the north, precisely because of the dire economic situation in Lebanon.
Ksenia, you've reported extensively from across the Middle East, right? You mentioned that you were in Lebanon a couple of times. I think I recall that you were even in the Dahiya neighborhood, which is that Hezbollah stronghold in Beirut, not long before the Second Lebanon War. You've reported from Syria, of course, from Gaza and other places. And you came out with a book about a year ago, I think in Hebrew only until now, correct? Not yet in English.
Yeah.
called on, if I'm loosely translating, but on heels in the Middle East, right? And I'm just curious, when you look back at you know, because before you became a, you later became a Knesset member, before all that you were a reporter. When you look back at these countries now, which are like disintegrating before our eyes, right? Syria, obviously, with this long civil war that took place and still very much a fractured country. Lebanon, with the instability there, is, and you think back 15, 16 years ago when you were visiting those countries, is the region more stable today? Is the region less stable today? How do you look at the kind of that arc over the last 15, 20 years?
Well, thank you for that question, Yaakov. Yeah, the book, by the way, will I hope that within the next few months will be also available in English and also in other languages. I believe that what I witnessed during these years when I was reporting the Middle East, it was the seeds of instability and of disintegration of the region that we are witnessing right now. Because a few of the processes that brought us to this tremendous change in the Middle East, which in one decade turned from, you know, it was never a stable place, but it's still, there were structures, there were countries. Countries just ceased to exist, you know, such as Libya, such as Yemen, such as Syria. We refer to them by their name, but they are no longer, you know, a country and as they used to be. I think that everything started back then. I think that the turning point was, of course, the 9/11, the growing power of the radical Islam, then the invasion of the US and allies to Iraq, and the growing hegemony of Iran and its malign influence over the Middle East and its attempt to build this Shia crescent, the inability of Palestinians to work against the radical Islamic power that took over the Gaza Strip in 2006 in elections, 2007 through the coup d'etat. If you would ask me 15 years ago if I think that, you know, things can get worse, and well, you know, I thought always that things always can get worse in the Middle East. Of course, you know, not me, not anybody could expect as dramatic events as, you know, the Arab Spring. I remember finding myself at Tahrir Square, standing and watching millions of Egyptians protest and rally against the regime. And I was tuning to the reports back in Israel when all of the specialists were saying, Mubarak will not fall. It cannot happen. Okay, so whether we were in state of denial, whether it was something else, but, you know, I think that, yes, things are, you know, things are developing here very quickly. I think we should expect the continuation of the Arab Spring. It's not over yet. It's not a one-time episode. It's the result of negligence and bad governance, of lack of unity and lack of national power, I would say, in the Arab states. And you know what? It makes me think that actually the Sykes-Picot agreement is still dictating basically this very messy and bloody reality in our region. It's not over yet.
Right. Well, very interesting. Ksenia Svetlova, thank you very much for joining us on the Jerusalem Post podcast. It was a pleasure to get your input and insight into the changes throughout the Middle East. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure to join you.
On Monday, July 19th, Ben & Jerry's announced its boycott of what they call the occupied Palestinian territories, without specifying what this includes, as well as its intention not to renew its contract next year with its partner in Israel. The news sent a ripple through the country, with formerly diehard fans announcing boycotts protesting the decision. Many Israeli politicians also spoke out, including Prime Minister Naftali Bennett, Foreign Minister Yair Lapid, and President Isaac Herzog. On the other hand, the BDS movement that led the pressure campaign have welcomed Ben & Jerry's decision and are already pushing for further action. So what does it look like at the factory itself, at the heart of the controversy?
On the real production floor of Ben & Jerry's ice cream, okay? It's very... We are producing here more than 10 years, and
The factory is located in Kiryat Maliki in southern Israel near Ashkelon. The city was established in 1951 as a tent city for masses of Jewish immigrants to settle in. The factory itself is flanked on all sides by other factories, including from competitor businesses such as Nestle. Walking between the rooms in the factory, visitors can see the different stages the ice cream goes through, from the vats that mix the ingredients together, all the way to the final packaging and shipping.
Pasteurize it, homogenize it, and then it's going through a plate heat exchanger. We're cooling it to about 4 degrees.
The factory itself is still lively today, producing huge numbers of cartons of ice cream every day for the country to enjoy. Avi Zinger, CEO of Ben & Jerry's Israel, warned that this could be the end to Ben & Jerry's in the country. Zinger has a license from Ben & Jerry's to manufacture and sell ice cream in Israel, a license that has to be renewed in 2022. He warned that if people are supportive of the decision to boycott occupied territories, this could prompt the company not to renew the license. On the other hand, he stressed that the best way to support Israel and stand in opposition to the decision is to continue to buy Ben & Jerry's in Israel. Zinger urged Israelis to understand that boycotting Ben & Jerry's Israel will not hurt the global company, but instead just hurt the everyday workers and farmers who are part of the business.
First of all, this is for us the most important thing, to have everybody in Israel understand that we are local, we are independent, we have nothing to do with the decision, we are against the decision, against the statements of the global company. We are paying a price now for that, because they say, after 35 years, go away. In the meantime, we need the support of everybody.
What will the future of Ben & Jerry's Israel hold? Only time will tell.
Thanks for joining us. Great to be back with you, Lahav, and we will see you all next week.